It's a real pleasure to talk about communism. Just after the victory of Obama, and when there is a violent crisis of capitalism. And to do that in a theater in New York is a magnificent thing. I begin by two very different things. On the one hand, some very abstract definitions. On the other hand, some very concrete points concerning the victory of Obama. And it's from the point of view of the relationship between the two philosophical definitions and concrete study of contemporary fact that I shall introduce the old world communism. So first, the definition is very briefly. I name event rupture in normal disposition of bodies and languages in a particular situation. Or if you want, I name event a rupture of the laws of the situation. So, and it's very important, an event is not the realization of a possibility which lies inside the situation. An event is the creation of a new possibility. An event changes not only the real, but the possible. An event is at the level not of simple possibilities, but at the level of possibility of possibilities. I name state or state of the situation the system of constraints which precisely limits the possibilities. For example, today I name state of our situation capitalist economy, constitutional form of government, juridical laws about property, labor, inheritance, army, police, and so on. All that composes the state of our situation. The state defines what is possible and what is not. So an event is always something which happens beyond the state, and is precisely the difference between an event and a simple fact. I name truth procedure or truth an organization of consequences of an event, the process, process of consequences of an event. And I name facts the consequences of the existence of the state. So the truth is not purely composed of facts. It's my opposition to pure empirism. The truth is also the becoming of a new subject. A new collective subject when the event is a political event. Concerning this new collective subject, I can speak of the creation of a truth. Concerning the state, I can speak of historical facts. For example, the revolution of October 1917 in Russia the creation of the new political Turks. In the same country, the victory of Soviet Union against the Nazis in 1945 is an historical fact. So in the same history, we can have sometimes some events and sometimes some historical facts. And finally, an historical fact is symbolic when it transforms the relationship between the identities of individuals and the representations of the poor. For example, when Lula became the president of Brazil, it was a symbolic fact and not only an historical fact, because it was the first time a simple worker occupies this place. Identities like worker, gay, black, woman, Jew, young, small, red hair, or Asian, are of no importance in the true political field, which is universal or generic. But the relationship between these predicates, these identities, and the power can be of some symbolic value concerning the action of the state. With all that in mind, we can say some words about the great victory of Obama. It was impossible for me to not say anything concerning this fact. Here and today. First, and I hope it's not too sad for you, it's clear that Obama's victory is not a political event. To have a comparison in the same field, the movement for the civil rights under the direction of Martin Luther King during the 60s has been a great popular event. But the success of Obama is for the moment, purely inside the established forms of the state, that is, capitalist economy, huge social inequalities, war outside, notably in Afghanistan, and purely formal democracy. So Obama's victory is a fact, maybe an important fact of the history of the state, but not for the moment a political event. Two, Obama's victory is certainly a very important symbolic fact of the state. Of the history of the state. In regard to the history of Africa and of black people, made of slavery, colonial domination, racism, and poverty, it's a glorious revenge and a strong symbol. And not only for Afro-Americans, but for humanity as such. But the symbolic level of the state is different of the political truth. This strong symbol can perfectly be at the political level empty or even negative. The decision will be finally not in the hands of Obama, but in the subjective determination of the people. Could you accept an advice from an old philosopher of an old country? I just can say to you, separate the labels. don't confuse them. Enjoy the symbolic. Don't trust the state. And concerning politics, rely only on yourself, on the collective action. But here we have a new problem. How can we be prepared to a political event? How can begin something which is really a political event and not a fact of the state, the history of the state? Generally, you know that we live in a sort of political passivity. We accept the general laws of the state as a necessity. To anticipate the creation of a new possibility, a possibility which is not a simple development of the state itself, at least at an intellectual or ideological level, we must have an idea, a general idea of the possibility of another possibility. We have the idea of the formal possibility of other possibilities. And during more than one century, communism has been the name for this idea. And it was, it's a great name first. To understand this name which was the name of the possibility of something else, we must return to the signification it had originally in two texts of Marx. One of 1844, the manuscripts of 1844, and the other of 1848, the famous manifesto of the Communist Party. In this text, communist first signifies negative. It signifies that the logic of places, of the fundamental subordination of real workers to a dominating class, can be surmounted. This structure of domination, which is that of history since antiquity, is not inevitable. Consequently, said Marx, the oligarchic power crystallized in the power of states, of those who detain the wealth and organize its circulation, is not ineluctable. All that is the negative part of the word communist. The communist hypothesis, it's a good word, an hypothesis, not a program, not a promise, not a realization, but like in science, maybe, an hypothesis. The communist hypothesis is that another collective organization can work. Each and everyone which this new organization will eliminate the inequality of wealth, and even, for Marx, the division of work. People will circulate between manual work and intellectual work, as well as between the city and the country. Each and everyone will be a polyvalent worker, is the expression of Marx himself. the private appropriation of monstrous fortunes and their transmission within families by inheritance will disappear. The existence of a coercive state apparatus protected by the military and the police, separated from the civil society, will no longer appear to be an obvious necessity. There will be, Marx tells us, after a brief sequence of what he names proletarian dictatorship, charged with destroying what remains of the old world, a long sequence of reorganization on the basis of the free association of produce and capital, which will support what Marx named a decline of the state. And it was maybe the most important definition of communism, which was the process of decline of the state. I remind you that the state is here not only the state as government, police, army, and so on, but all what limits the possibilities, what limits the possibilities of collective creation. So communism at the middle of the 19th century designates this very general set of intellectual representations. And this set is the horizon for any action, as local and limited in time as it may be, which, breaking with the order of the established state, composes a fragment of a new politics, a fragment of politics of emancipation. It is, in short, communism, an idea whose function is regulatory and not a program. It's absurd to qualify the communist hypothesis to be an utopia, because it serves to produce, between different politics, line of demarcation. For a given political sequence, it is either compatible with the hypothesis of equality, with the communist hypothesis, and it is emancipated in the wide sense, or else it is opposed to the communist hypothesis, and it is reactionary. Communism, in this sense, is a heuristic hypothesis, frequently used in polemics, even if the word does not appear. And so, it's a useful idea for the political determination and not the concrete program of this politics. Maybe you know this violent sentence of Jean-Paul Sartre in the 50s of the last century. Any anti-communist is a dog. If we correctly read this abrupt sentence, it's true. Any action of the state, because it's sent, it's clear, any action of the state that appears formally contradictory with the communist hypothesis, in its generic sense, must be judged as opposed to the emancipation of the whole of humanity. And so it's opposed to the properly human destiny of humanity. As we know, the contemporary, that is to say, capitalist, name social existence, for the capitalist, the correct name for social existence is competition. That is to say, it's the war of interests and nothing else. But the war of interests is certainly the infra-human part of humanity. In another interview, the same Sartre says, in substance, I quote, if the communist hypothesis is not right, if it is not applicable, this means that humanity is not in itself something very different from ants or termites. What is saying that? That if competition, free market, the search for little jouissance, and the walls that protect you from the desire of the weak are the alpha and omega of all existence, collective or private, the human beast is not worth a scrap. So, only to be a real actor, a real activist of the becoming human of the human beast, we have to know the history of the communist hypothesis. And we have to study the question, is really the communist hypothesis right or completely wrong? In fact, there are two great historical sequences of this hypothesis, and this is why the question is complex. The sequence of its creation, the creation of the hypothesis, and that of the first attempt to realize it. The first sequence begins from the French Revolution, and she goes to the Paris Commune. Let us say from 1792 to 1871. The first sequence of the communist hypothesis. It lasted then about 80 years of creation of the hypothesis. This sequence links under the idea of communism the popular mass movement with the notion of the Caesar of power. That is the concrete form of the idea during this sequence. Mass movement on one side, and on the other side, Caesar of power. It was about organizing the popular movement under multiple forms, demonstrations, strikes, uprisings, armed action, around the figure of overthrowing the state. We know the state was real, the state in general, not only the government. The state was the form of restriction possibility, must be strong to emancipate the possibilities as such. And the only possible actor of this destruction is the mass movement, and first the mass movement of workers. And this overthrow of the state is an insurrectional overthrow, which is called, as you know, revolution. So finally, there is strong relationship between the communist idea and the practical motive of revolution. This revolution must suppress the existing form of society, private property, inheritance, the separation of humanity into nations, the division of work and so on, and establish communist equality, or what the working class thinkers of the 19th century, as my friend Jacques Rancière has so well analyzed, name the community of equals. Communism was, by insurrection, the realization of the community of equals. This sequence closes with the astonishing newness and the radical failure of the Paris Commune in 1971. The Commune was the supreme form of this combination of popular movement, working class direction, and armed insurrection. It showed the extraordinary vitality of this formula. It was able, as you know, to exercise the power of a completely new type for 2 months in one of the largest capitals of Europe. But it also showed its limits, for it was not able either to extend the revolution to a national scale or efficaciously organize resistance to the counter-revolution, which, with the tacit support of foreign powers, was able to count of an efficient military apparatus. The second sequence of the communist hypothesis goes from 1917, the Russian Revolution, to 1976, the end of the Cultural Revolution in China, but also the end of the militant movement in Europe and America and in other places, which arose through the world somewhere between 1966 and 1975, and whose center, from the point of view of political innovation, was May 1968 in France, and its consequences during the years that followed. But you know that during also this sequence, we have many other things. For example, the great resistance to the Vietnam War in America, and the movement of the youth practically in all countries of the world. This second sequence lasts about 50 years. But notice that it is separated from the first by a gap of about the same length, more than 40 years. So the history of the communist hypothesis is not a continuous history. It's a continuity by sequence, which are separated. It's important for us, but maybe we are between 2 seconds. All our problems. So this second sequence, which begins with the Russian Revolution, is dominated by one question, and it's very important. How can we be victorious? That is the central and practically unique question during this year. How, to the contrary of the Paris Commune, can we endure in face of the sanguinary reaction of rich people and their mercenaries? How can we organize the new power the new state in such a way that it will not be destroyed by its enemies. Lenin's greatness is to have found the first answer to these questions. And it is certainly not for nothing that Lenin danced on the snow when the insurrection lasted in Russia one day longer than the Paris Code. This obsession with victory and the real, when concentrated on the problems of organization and discipline, and was entirely contained, starting from 1902 and Lenin's What Is to Be Done, the famous text of Lenin, What Is to Be Done, in the theory and the practice of the centralized and homogeneous class party. We can say that the communist parties on the day give the body in their high-road discipline to the rhythm of the communist hypothesis. This characteristic construction of the second sequence of the hypothesis, the party, actually did resolve the question inherited from the first sequence, the question of the victory in Russia, in China, in Albania, in Korea, in Vietnam, in some sense in Cuba, under the direction of communist parties. The complete revolution of the political and social order had won. After the first sequence, whose leading line was the formulation of the communist hypothesis and of its reality as a movement, the mass movement, there was effectively a second sequence whose leading line was disciplined and militarized organization, local victory, duration and construction of a new state. As is normal, the second sequence created in its turn a problem it did not have the means to resolve with the methods that had permitted it to resolve the problem left it by the first. In effect, the party Communist Party, which was the body of the communist hypothesis. The Communist Party adapted to the insurrection of military victory that was successful against the weakened reactionary power, proved to be inapt for the construction of the state around the dictatorship of the proletariat in the sense of Marx. That is, the state organizing the transition towards the non-state, a power organizing the non-power, the dialectic form of the decline of the state. Under the form of the party state, like Russia, China, and in other places, a new form of state which was authoritarian and terrorist was experimented. And this state was, in any case, very far from the practical life of the people and very far from the idea of the decline of the state itself. The deployment of sanguinary police violence was in no way sufficient to save it from the inertia of its internal bureaucracy. With the ferocious competition imposed on it by its adversary, it had hardly taken more than 50 years to demonstrate that it would never triumph. The most important contemporary problem is that the political form of the party is inadequate to assure the real regulation and the creative transformation of the communist hypothesis. And it's to this problem that are consecrated the last important convulsions of the second sequence. The Cultural Revolution in China and the nebulous, named, for example, May 68 in France. In China, Mao's maxim on this point is no communism without a communist movement. No communism without a communist movement. The party is not sufficient. If we have not a movement, we have nothing. And so the party must at any cost be steeped in the mazes to regenerate it, to de-bureaucratize it, and launch it in the transformation of the real world. The Cultural Revolution attempts this task and quickly becomes chaotic and violent. The definition of the enemy being either uncertain or directed against the unique pillar of society, the Communist Party itself. Mao had something to do with this when he declared, I quote, "We do not know in our country where the bourgeoisie is. Well, the bourgeoisie is in the Communist Party." So the struggle was finally between the party and itself. And it destroyed the social consistency. Finally, the old order had to be re-established in the worst conditions. In France, after May 68, the dominating motif was that the organized collective action must create a new political space and not reproduce the centralized management of the state. The principal content would be new forms of organization and action, enveloping in the same political vision intellectuals and workers, and proposing to prolong the communist hypothesis even beyond the logic of Sizer of power. Nevertheless, even if this experience was put under new forms, from the hand of the 1870s, it can be considered that overall, the modern form of the reactionary state was once again dominant in Mao under cover of democracy. The word communism is today either completely forgotten or practically identified with criminal experience. It's why the political situation and the ideological situation is so confusing. Because in fact, the communist hypothesis, with or without the word communism, which is only a word, you can speak, for example, of the egalitarian hypothesis, or the hypothesis of radical equality, or but all that remains the right hypothesis, the right great idea of a new possibility, and not only of realization of all possibilities inscribed in the state itself. I see no hope. If this hypothesis must be abandoned, once more, with some words or some other words. if it is no evil to do anything whatsoever as far as the collective action is concerned. Without the horizon of equality and communism, without this idea, nothing in historical and political evolution is of a nature to interest the philosopher. Let everyone mind his own business and talk no more about it. In fact, what has become our task? Or we can even say our philosophic duty is to contribute to defining a new mode of existence of the hypothesis itself. New by the type of political experimentation this hypothesis can give rise to. We have learned from the second sequence and its final failure, we must return to the conditions of existence of the communist hypothesis and not only perfect the means of our struggle. The lesson of the second sequence is that the question of victory cannot be the center of our view. We have and we must experiment something new. And take at a real distance the question of the poll. What is a politics which is not confused with the question of the poll? That is our new challenge. We cannot be satisfied with the dialectic relation between the state and the mass movement, with the preparation of the insurrection, with the construction of a powerful and disciplined organization, with the concept of revolution, which today is obscure. We must, in reality, re-establish first the hypothesis, communist or egalitarian, in the ideological and militant field. And with respect to this, we are closer to a set of problems already in the mind in the 19th century than we are to the grand history of the revolution of the last century. We are much more in the 19th century than in the last century. In the dialectical vision of history, we have some time to go before. Just as after maybe 1840, we are now confronted to absolutely cynical capitalists, more and more inspired by the idea that only wealth counts, that the poor are just lazy, that the Africans are backward, and that the future, with no discernible limit, belongs to the civilized bourgeoisie of the Western world. All kinds of phenomena from the 19th century reappear. Extraordinarily extended zones of misery within rich countries themselves. Forever growing inequalities. Radical cut between the people of the working classes or the unemployed and the middle classes. The complete dissolution of political power in the service of property and capitalist profit. Terrible crisis of the financial system. Disorganization of revolutionaries and the nihilist despair of large portions of the youth. the servility of a large majority of intellectuals, and the experimental activity of some groups in quest of the contemporary means to establish, re-establish, find a new definition for the communist hypothesis. All these characteristics are very close to the political situation which was dominant in Europe in the middle of the 19th century. And it is why the apparent victory of capitalism against the second sequence of communist hypothesis has been, in fact, a very strong reaction, a very strong return to something very old. The modernization of contemporary capitalism is also the return to the cynical capitalism of the 19th century. And this is probably why, as in the 19th century, the question is not for us the victory of the communist hypothesis, but the conditions of its existence. Our problems are much more the problems of Marx than the problems of Lenin. And that war, the great question of the revolutionaries of the 19th century, first, give a historical existence to the hypothesis produce the conviction in large masses of people that another possibility exists and that we are not prisoners of the definition of the world by our enemies. Give an historical existence to the hypothesis, well, that is our task. In that sort of interphasal period that is oppressing us. It's complex, but after all, it's exalted too. By combining constructions of thought, because at the beginning of an idea, of a new form of existence of an idea, there is a way constructions of thought, like construction of a new form of dialectics by Marx. These constructions of thought are always global and universal. But we have also new political experimentations, which are local and singular. And it's a mixture of the two, great construction of thought at a universal level and political experimentation at a local or singular level, which finally can produce the new form of the communist hypothesis. This existence must be simultaneously in consciousness by new forms of representations of what is the political event, and in the real by the result and by learning of local experimentation. So we can open the third sequence of this great idea. We can. And if we can, we must. Thank you. speak out slowly as you talk. And not in French, but near French. Realization or a virtual realization of the communist hypothesis. Soviet Union was dead before its death. Soviet Union as a political body was absolutely a dead experience. From when the question? How we can fix the death of the Soviet Union are something interesting, universally interesting, for the development of the communist hypothesis. It's a great discussion. But certainly, during the 60s, that sort of experience was of no interest, certainly. And so, the final death is in the hand of the 80s, a lot of time after, but it has been the death of the dead. And it is why, it's very interesting, the collapse of Soviet Union has been not at all an event, but only a sort of internal process where the direction of the state decides that it was finished. No revolution, no insurrection, no mass demonstration, nothing like that, but only the direction of the state, which finally says, that sort of experience, that sort of language, to speak of communism and so on, is completely without signification. And so they decide to become new capitalists. And they become. Absolutely. Yeah. And so it's a good example of the distinction between the fact of the history of a state and an event. Precisely, the collapse of Soviet Union is a very important fact of the history of state, but without any power of creation, without the opening of something new for the people. Only, finally, the sort of imitation of the dominant position of the capitalist countries. And it is why we have some interesting phenomena about the middle of the 70s, but after that, I think we are really at the end of the second sequence. And it is why the end of the second sequence is not, in my opinion, the collapse of Soviet Union, but before.
Yes. Yes. I have a double question. First, I'll begin following up your comment on the question about the second sequence. You mentioned the names of Mao and Lenin, but you don't mention the names of Stalin and Trotsky. Do you see the struggle between Stalin and Trotsky in the 20s and 30s and subsequent ideological issue is irrelevant? And the second question is really a question about dates. In your chronology, the first sequence, you went from 1792, which presumably is the declaration of the French Republic. I would have thought you would have started with Tableau and Monsieur Vincent des Égaux.
I can't take a
the chronology in 1792 verse. The first difference, it began with 1792. I would have thought he would have started with Kabbalah and the Pharisee of Egypt.
I think the second part of your question concerning Babeuf and all the motifs, the idea of equality during the French Revolution, I think it's a part of the beginning of the first sequence, absolutely. It is why I indicate that the beginning of the first sequence is not exactly Marx, but before, with some part of the revolutionaries of the French Revolution, and Babeuf, naturally, is the most important example. After that, after the Russian Revolution, naturally there is a very complex field. I cannot restitute the complex history of the second sequence. Naturally, there has been opposition, different vision, contradiction between Trotsky and Stalin, and after that contradiction between Mao and the Russian Revolution and so on. And so the second sequence is not a linear sequence, not at all. And the first one is not at all a linear sequence because there is also contradiction between Marxism, Bakunin, anarchy, and so on. And so the history of a great idea, like the idea of communism, is naturally very complex and contradictory story. But my point was only to distinguish between two great sequences and to say that the second sequence are closed in some sense to the first, and that the second sequence was certainly weak or closed, and so to open to the idea that we have to find the terms of a third hypothesis. This third hypothesis will be certainly also contradictory with terrible ideological struggles and so on. The life of an hypothesis. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Where in the world do you see today greater possibility for the communist hypothesis? And where in the world do you see today greater possibilities for philosophy?
I don't know. I think the situation today is completely new. Because we have, first, a new hegemony of capitalism. We have in a world where there is no other possibility which is realized in terms of state, camp, and so on. And it's a completely different situation than during the Cold War. Because the Cold War was in fact the affirmation of the existence of two possibilities, two major possibilities. Maybe it was a fiction. Maybe the Soviet Union was not a real incarnation of communist hypothesis. Okay. But for everybody in the world, the fact was that the political situation is with two possibilities. And maybe more. But not one. Today, we have the very strong idea that there exists only one possibility. The philosopher must say that if there exists only one possibility, this possibility is not a possibility, but a necessity. The very simple, important remark. And so, in fact, we are in a world where the dominant idea is the idea that one form of the global world is a necessity. And it is why today the restriction much more strong than ever. And there is, that is the illusion of democracy. That is the great illusion of democracy today. Because, okay, we are in democracy, but we are in democracy inside something which is not the result of a choice, but the result of a necessity. And so there is a relationship between the formal dimension of the political consciousness, democracy, as something which is better than all other forms of power, okay? And relationship between that and the necessity of a unique world. A world which is not open to another possibility. So, the attempt of the world today is to suppress any possibility of an event. That is the point. Or to treat any event as pathological or criminal. Why? Because an event is something which is beyond the necessity, something which is at the level of possibility, of a new possibility. If there exists only one form of good world, with capitalist economy and representative government, there is no possibility in this sense. And so the communist hypothesis today has to be re-established in a new context, in a context which is not a context where exist, in fact, two different politics, two different forms of state, and so on, but in a context where exists and dominates one form of world with its economic definition and its political definition, and so on. And so, this is why we are in an other sequence. That is, we have to find the terms of the communist hypothesis, of the hypothesis of a new possibility, inside, in a context where, in fact, practically everybody, and ourselves too, in one sense, accept the necessity. And so it's a philosophical question. What is the relationship between the sort of necessity and the general idea of another possibility?
You seem to posit the idea or the hypothesis of communism more or less like a regulative idea, to speak in Kantian terms. It reminds me of, you know, the idea of God, freedom, even the way you connect it to equality. Equality is not something we can really imagine. It's something that really rules our way of dealing with people. You can't really imagine how two people can be equal, but you see how there, it's more like a negative idea, what I would call a regulative idea. Is that a correct interpretation of what you have in mind? And this makes me
think
of religion, really.
It's
more like a
religious regulative idea. I perfectly understand your question. You know, my friend, I have had a discussion with my friend and comrade Jacques Rancière about the question of equality, because it's also a great idea of Rancière, another French philosopher. The idea of equality. And he was saying that finally equality is always an idea which is concrete only in relationship with inequality, in fact. And that equality is like a principle or an idea which arises to create a new struggle against inequality. And so, and I agree with you. Finally, equality or communism is an idea, but in the sense where this idea is useful to determine our position concerning inequality. And so it is why, certainly, communism means not a state. And that is maybe the great misfortune, the great error, maybe, of the second thing. That communism, that is equality, can be a state. But it's probably not because the communist idea is always an idea which permits to discern between inequality and something else. And so it's an idea for struggle, for concrete struggle, and not an idea for general or global realization of a paradise. And there is, maybe there is a religious interpretation of the communist idea, which was very active in the 19th century too, which is like a promise. Tomorrow we have the communism, and there was something like that in the second sequence too. The communism has something like a realization of terrestrial paradise. And it's not my vision. My vision is it's an idea in the regulatory sense, in fact, that is in relationship to concrete inequality.
But here.
I was wondering if you could clarify a little bit the criteria that you have available for adequately recognizing an event. Because it seems to be the case that what one identifies as an event might very well be, in your terminology, a fact of a situation. So what sort of criteria do you have for assessing the accuracy of an event, or identifying, say, a misrecognition of an event?
How would I recognize an event in addition to a fact? Okay. Yes, we have no guarantee. and it is like in concrete existence. For example, I think that love is a truth procedure. It's a useful comparison, politics and love. it's the same question. How do you there is an encounter with something else. And how we know that it's a good person? How we know that it's really a love event, it's really an encounter which creates something new in the life, or maybe an error, something which is on the form of the newness of an encounter, but finally which is the form of repetition, return to childhood, and complex, and so on. And so the relationship between love and desire, between love and encounter, and so on, is a very complex field. And we have no guarantee that you have. And this is why there is so bad stories, personal existence. And there is also bad stories in the political field. Sometimes we can have the conviction that we see the fundamental event, but finally it's not really. It's a fact which has the appearance of an event or something like that. So finally what decides is the apparition of a really new form of subjectivity. And it is why in my definition of an event there is always consequences of the event, and not only the event, the pure event. It's very important. So there is something retroactive. There's something retroactive in the qualification of an event. There is no possibility to say immediately, okay, it's an event. And it is exactly the same thing in the different form of truth, in art, in science, in law. Contradictory. On one side, on the one hand, we were in the second sequence, by many features of the second sequence. For example, the idea that the matter of politics is the class struggle, the contradiction of classes. We maintain the idea of dictatorship of proletariat. We maintain, finally, the idea of the party. Certainly, we have to create the party with many conditions and so on, to create the party in the movement and not apart the movement and so on. But we maintain the general idea of a party which is the representative of the politics, the body of the politics. And so on one side. On the other side, we have concrete experience which were very different, which were experience of creation of something in the movement itself, acceptation of something very long, very passionate, and not immediate, not insurrection, not precipitation, and so on. And And so we have the idea of a new time. And today, I think that the question of time is fundamental in politics. The difficulty is that the domination is always a figure of time. And the capitalist domination is a figure of short time. And to create a long time, a time which is not the time of the capitalist excitation, if you want, which is not the time of traders, poor traders, and which is not the time of the speculation and so on, the time of the circulation, it's a new time. And in the 70s, we don't know that we must go beyond the second sequence. And so the experience was a very important experience in life too. The experience of the end of a sequence. And the end of a sequence, the part of the sequence. But it's also something which is not exactly in the sequence because so through the death. And so we have experimented the sequence and the end of the sequence simultaneously, the same experience. So all these experiences were contradictory. And many people have for conclusion that all that was finally nothing. And it's possible to say that something is nothing when it is precisely the end of something. And the confusion between nothing and something which is finishing, was the conclusion of many people. My conclusion was different. That's why I talk to you about communism today, and not democracy, and this is why also my relationship to the victory of Obama is cautious.
Question for Balcony.
I am optimistic negative because I think that it's not true that that we are at the end of history. Fukuyama is wrong. He knows himself that he is wrong. He had made autocritic. and why? Because we can see today that the idea that the world created by the modern forms of capitalism and the modern forms of democracy is not a stable world which is promised to a great economy. Not at all. And so, negatively, I think we are going to many difficulties, many contradictions, maybe some brutal wars and so on. We are not at all in a peaceful world which comes. And the crisis is a symbol of all that. The crisis, the actual crisis, is only the symbol of the reality of the world, and not at all of its compassion. It's a first term. And the second term is that my conviction is that it's not true that people are so happy today. Not true. They don't imagine, and the question of imagination is a true question, they don't imagine something else. And so it's a question of the relationship between necessity and possibility, which is the great question today. Is there a level where we can imagine, in fact, that the possibility of a new possibility is itself possible? Or are we really in a strong limitation of possibilities inside the law of the world as it is? But if this world is in crisis, cannot, during a long time, pretend that it is the final form of the world. And it is why I am optimistic in that sense, negatively. For the creation of the new forms of the third hypothesis, we have to work. We imagine, we propose this new form of soul, we propose this new figure of philosophy to experiment locally new political possibilities and so on. We have to prepare ourselves to something which we don't know. We have to prepare ourselves to the unknown, because we felt that we cannot calculate. And so I am optimistic. Exactly on one point, it's possible to be prepared or to prepare the subject, the human subject, to something else that we cannot know today, but which certainly will come, will happen. And it's my optimistic vision. I name Cuba as a consequence. I did not forget Cuba. Cuba is an eccentric case in one sense, because in Cuba, the Communist Party, in fact, comes after the revolution and not before. It's a very strange and very interesting story, because the construction of the Communist Party by Castro begins after the revolution. The revolution was on a very different manner. A small group with peasants and so on, a new form. But everybody knows that in Cuba, the discussion is open concerning the passage from the second sequence to the sequence. The great difficulty, and why Cuba is interesting for us, is that apparently the choice is not closed. It's not by necessity the choice of Soviet Union. That is the choice to finally destroy the socialist system completely and to create a new bureaucratic capitalism. The discussion is here. And it is why the question of the passage from the terms of the second sequence to the possibility of the third sequence is, for the moment, always local. And cannot be, it can be global at the level of new concepts, philosophical thoughts, and so on. But in terms of political experience, it will be certainly enduring a long time with a local dimension. And it's why we have to pay attention to small experiences today. There is no political experience without interest. All what is new, all what is not in the classical pace of democratic politics, all what is really a new experimentation is certainly of interest. And so we have to circulate between two very different levels. First, the great idea, philosophy, concepts, abstract formulations, and so on, and on the other side, all local experimentation of the new political vision. And it is our gap, it is a gap today between the two. But we have to be in this gap.
Two hands on that.
I wish we had a whole night of debate to how certain should be the victory, but as we don't, I'll just give you a question. You didn't speak much about proletariat and how do you feel proletariat or the relevancy of the proletariat has changed since the end of the second wave? What is the relevancy, how has it changed, especially within the last 30 years with the change of technology, the technology changes, how has it changed?
Well,
yes, we have to distinguish concerning the concept of proletariat between its objective signification, workers in factories, productive class, and so on, and its political signification, which was marked too. The class which can realize this communist hypothesis. Because for metaphysical reasons, because for Marx, the proletariat was the representation of the generic humanity. And it is why the emancipation of proletariat is also the emancipation of humanity itself. Proletariat is this part of humanity which has nothing at all, only its proper existence. And so it's something like a naked humanity. Humanity as such, without property, without predicates, without anything. And because the proletariat was, in that sense, nothing at all, it was also able to create the new, as a world of complete equality. And so, proletariat was the subject of revolution. That is the most important point. And it also a characteristic of the first and of the second synod. There is a subject of politics which exists in the world, which is not a creation, which has an objective existence. It is the proletariat, working class, you can add the name you want. So there is an objective support for the political subjectivity. It's a great question today to your question, to the question today, to examine this possibility. But we can say two things. First, maybe the proletariat today is transformed by new technologies and so on, so that it cannot be in the function of generic humanity. Second, it's not a necessity that the new sequence of communist hypothesis defines an objective subject of politics. We can have, perfectly, it's a possibility, the realization step by step of communist hypothesis without a general subject of the political action, like the proletariat for Marx. So all that is in discussion. Certainly, in my experience, my political experience, my local experience, it's certainly always a necessity to that the political determination is its relationship with the productive part of population, productive part of people. We cannot do really something without them. And it's purely experimental. I know that. I know that we must organize in one sense something which is common to workers and intellectuals. Something which is common between ordinary people and middle class, and so on. Without that, we cannot go beyond the state as it is. But, so there is naturally political work is by necessity a work with that sort of social determination. The poor, the workers, and it's also a relationship between different social positions. Because the state, it's a general definition, the state is always a strict organization of separation in civil society, always. Everybody is at its place. Everybody has a place. And political determination is always a change of place, the travel from place to place, something like that, a diagonal passage. So the question of the working class today is a question which is two parts. First, the question of the subject, the general subject of revolutions, politics, and so on, and second, the place of the working class in the field of concrete political experimentation. To the first point, I don't know really. The destiny of the political subject in this sense is obscure. On the second point, I can say that, yes, we must do something with workers or minorities.
Well, I'm sorry,
the last question.
Okay.
So it's a, you know it, the state. you can see immediately the limitation of possibility. okay. You are the last possibility.
Can you speak louder, please?
In terms of creating a third sequence, you talked about the importance of sort of developing a global universal theory, but also experimentation at the local level. So I'm just curious more, how do we do that in a way that those two streams complement each other, reinforce each other, advance each other? Or I guess another way is, how much in the work we do influence the coming of the next event?
Yeah.
Precisely our situation to find the means of something more and more linked between the general level of thought, ideas, philosophy, and so on, and the concrete political experimentations. We cannot really know the passage. There is a gap, certainly. There is a gap, but we know. When Marx writes in 1840 his commentary of the philosophy of Hegel, is not immediately in relationship with the experience of workers. So there's not to be completely afraid of this gap. We have to work in the two directions. Maybe the concept, which is at the intersections of the two, is the concept of equality in the sense of our discussion. The concept of equality, in one sense, is a very abstract concept, which is a concept that's on the side of idea, of principle, and so on. And on the other side, it's a concrete concept between practically all important political questions are questions of inequality. And so it's by a new conception of equality in its relationship to concrete situations that we can find the new forms of the communist hypothesis in the real, and not only in the intellectual representation.